afternoon. I'd like to welcome everyone to the January meeting, the first of 2008 of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. We're going to typically, and most parts of the year, we do a work session one day and a business session the next. The General Assembly will do both our work session and our business meeting today, Wednesday. I want to thank everybody for traveling safely, and it's turning a beautiful day outside, and we have a beautiful agenda to capitalize on that. For starters, I would like to recognize Commissioner Eckern, who's going to talk about the many awards and much of the excellence that occurs within the Department of Transportation on a daily basis. And as the first meeting of 2008, it's probably a good opportunity to look back on 2007 and some of the good things. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Now I have to take 2 seconds and smile. And he promised he wouldn't come back.
You didn't believe him, did you?
Good afternoon, everybody, and Happy New Year. It's nice to have you here, and it's nice to be able to be first on the agenda to talk about something that is obviously, in whether it's Matt or whether it's I, in our jobs as your arm in our agencies, one of the things that we take a lot of pride in, and I can tell you this is true having experienced it in 3 states and with my peers across the country, you take tremendous pride, and it doesn't take you long to develop it, in terms of what your staff does every day for the public and the achievements that they reach every year as they move and change the pace of transportation in this country. And so it's seldom that we take some conscious effort to sit down and try to highlight some of that excellence for you. And I asked the Secretary if we could do that today, because I thought it was really an auspicious time to do it as we begin 2008. Normally, we would have what we call the Garver Conference in May this year as a part of our strategies to stretch dollars. We are not going to hold the Garver Conference. And that's our event where we try to make sure that we get some recognition done. So I thought and asked and believed that this would be just a great opportunity, because I've gotten to know what advocates for transportation the members of this board are over my first 2 years here. And so you always want to work with a receptive audience. So what you have at your place, and each of you should have a little table that looks like this, because I'm not going to read all the names today, but I am going to ask some teams and some individuals to stand up, because over the last year, in 2007, we received recognition around projects and innovative practices that we have achieved as a Commonwealth on 42 different occasions, not counting an additional 10 that we award internally and through the governor's programs. So that what that totals up to you, if you look at these charts about right, is 51 different activities and initiatives recognized for their excellence and their contribution to the future of the Commonwealth. And I wanted to highlight about 6 or 7 of those in just a few minutes here. And what you see in the audience, or the people you see in the audience, are representatives of those teams. And so as I talk about any given item, I'm going to ask them to stand up. I won't go through their names, because Norwegians don't do phonetics very well. You need to think about that. And so I'd rather not embarrass myself by doing that. If it's Peterson or Nelson or Johnson, I'm really good at it. And I've arranged these in a particular order because I wanted to get kind of a showcase around what we have adopted as our strategic initiatives. As we take the goals adopted by the CTB, the goals of the governor's programs, and our business plan, tie all those things together. I've talked to the board several times about our focus around changing the transportation system, improving our business practices on an ongoing basis to give you the most efficient, effective, and sustainable transportation business in the country. And third, our focus around our people. There's no doubt over the last 5 years that VDOT has undergone some of the most radical change ever attempted by a DOT in the country. And we use that simple statistic that the people that are here providing services and direction today are fewer in number than when we began the interstate era in 1958. How have they accomplished that? They've accomplished that through what I'm showing you here today. A team approach, new business practices, using technology, and just plain dedication to public service. That's what excites me about being the commissioner of VDOT. The first project, and so as you look down this chart, I want to highlight a couple of initiatives in the business practice area, which highlight really our technology growth. And the first project I've got is what we have labeled as the Integrated Project Manager Program. And I'd like that team to rise. Well, I'd like them to stand up. You don't have to rise. Stand up. That got the Digital Government Award from the Center for Digital Government, and it was recognized by the Commissioner's Award as an outstanding achievement in innovation and quality improvement. This is the team that took an outdated and very costly system to manage our projects in the field, translated it, turned it into web-based software, and made it transparent for use throughout the agency. You can't accomplish that by just using anybody. These people are experts in the business they do. They know what the system has to do to accomplish good, efficient use and ensure that our projects are managed on a tight basis. That's one of the keys to helping us get to on time and on budget, as we've demonstrated in calendar year 2000. These folks are terrific in what they do, and so I wanted to make sure that you saw the kinds of folks that really put those systems together for us. The second project that I wanted to highlight today really deals with, under the business practices piece, something that's near and dear to our hearts as we've managed change in funding across the programs that we operate in. So I'm going to ask the team that has developed a federal aid paving schedule contract development tool to kind of stand up. Now, why is this important? Again, it's another use of technology, but as you know, over the last 2 years, we have started to utilize federal aid on the maintenance side for the first time in our history. That brings a new level of complexity to how we deliver projects in a traditional maintenance setting. That means you've got to meet some new requirements, you've got to set up your funding differently, and in order to accomplish that, this team sat down and created a contract development schedule that included all the environmental clearances, the safety reviews, and the Federal Highway Administration requirements. They did it as an independent project within a district, and we have now spread that throughout the department as a usable tool so that on maintenance projects, we no longer have to start from scratch on every maintenance project that's going to utilize federal aid. This gives the department that template. This makes us efficient. This ensures that when we get at the end of the day, we've got projects that are ready to let. In the Stanton District, this group, by the way, comes from the Stanton District. In fiscal year 2006, we were able to attribute about $9.4 million in savings because of the use of this scheduling system. We estimate, as it permeates throughout the department, that it will save us about $100 million annually. What does that mean? It turns into pavement. It turns into smoother roads. It turns into safe bridges. That's why this kind of stuff gets me excited. So another neat business practice change.
Mr. Chairman, that means the Stanton District gets a percentage of every other district's money back.
Rick Wong will explain to you later the copyright laws and a few things like that. But it's good innovation. We appreciate that. Now I want to highlight a couple of projects in the transportation system category as we use our business plan. The first one is the Chickahominy Bridge project. It's the Judith Stewart Dresser Memorial Bridge on Route 5 over the Chickahominy Bridge. Okay. That got a governor's award for teamwork, and it was recognized by the commissioner as an outstanding achievement in the system, in our project development system. Here's what they faced, and obviously Mr. McCarthy understands what we were facing in this particular project. 68-year-old swing bridge near Williamsburg deteriorated and repeatedly closed, and every time we had to shut it down, it was a 63-mile detour.
Wow.
This team put together the program. Preliminary engineering developed a project to replace it with a 2,500-foot-long fixed-span bridge 52 feet over the water, so you got good water clearance. That project, we thought, would take 3 or more years to develop. They did it in 18 months. The total cost of engineering was 5% of the construction budget as compared to a typical 12 to 15%. That turned into real dollars at about $5.3 million worth of savings in that project development cost, again turned into real projects. What really caught my attention about this team is the fact that one of their members, a gentleman by the name of John Wells, passed away before the project was completed. He was recognized by this team, who organized a special event for him over at the library. And unfortunately, he died at the age of 52. But one of his loves was the research of history and the protection of the environment. And in his role on this team, he helped that team ensure that that the project was in fact environmentally sound and recognized its true history and what it played as a role in the Commonwealth. That team, as I got to know them and had a chance to visit with them, you get a real sense of their enthusiasm and their pride and their dedication to one another. It was the care that they had for a coworker. So you saw an awful lot of the best of VDOT right there in one project.
Mr. Chairman, this project didn't even exist 5.5 years ago, and our district came to me that summer of 2002 and said, we have a serious bridge problem, and I said, well, I hope you can fix it, and they said it's going to cost a lot of money that we don't have, and they put this team together on it, and in lightning fast time, they got this thing moving and are getting it done, and it is in one of the most historic areas of the country. They've done it sensitively, efficiently, and effectively. I am very, very proud of them for the job they've done on this one.
Appreciate that. Thank you. That's a compliment that we all take very seriously. The second project I wanted to highlight is the Lord Delaware Bridge replacement on Route 33 in West Point, Fredericksburg District. So I got to have that meeting. I think we're all aware of the West Point Bridge and what a statement that is and what dedication it took to deliver that project. It is one of those projects that really faced a number of environmental challenges, particularly as we dealt with the sensitivity of the Chesapeake Bay watershed, including time of year restrictions for working in the water, tidal basin influences, and a really soft subsurface. Those of us that are in the engineering community really get nervous about that kind of stuff, if you really want to know the truth, because then you get to drive piles all over the place. End result of this project, very frankly, it met every environmental requirement that was established for it in the environmental process. It was completed on time and on budget. It forged really strong partnerships between federal, state, and local groups as we were in the process of bringing that project to fruition. It is one of those hallmark projects that you can look at in terms of the term we've used here around context-sensitive solutions, because it really welded together those four tests that I always talk about: public involvement, good engineering, sound financial planning, and a respect for the environment and the quality of life here in the Commonwealth. It used some really innovative bridge construction techniques. And if I'm not mistaken, this is the bridge where we had trouble getting the dedication set a couple of times because it snowed when we were going to do it. But this group I'm really proud of, and it is a beautiful bridge. I've been into the West Point community and looked at what it's done and what it did to bring that community together. So let's give them a round of applause. System transformation that I wanted to highlight is the rest area program, and particularly the Interstate 64 rest area that we opened up this summer, and why it was important. It represents a series, the beginning of a series of directions that we've started to build green buildings, to reutilize what we have, and to ensure that we get the best use of materials available and don't just start from scratch. I gotta have Jake Porter stand up. He's been the leader of this thing. If you wanna get really engaged with somebody who has enthusiasm and love for what they're doing and see the vision of how we can reduce our environmental footprint and still have quality, talk to Jake. He'll get you so charged up, it'll just drive you nuts. Simple examples. In this particular rest area, we got the Green Leadership Award from the James River Green Building Council. It's a 9,000 square foot safety rest area with all the state-of-the-art traveler amenities that you would want. They have a system that collects rain from the roof and takes about 250,000 gallons of that rainwater, which is then used for flushing the restroom toilets. So they've built a cistern into the place, and so all of a sudden you're not having to drain on a water supply. They have a stormwater bioretention facility that's filtered to control and filter runoff from the parking lots before we put it back out into the watershed. They have a 32-well geothermal system that uses the constant temperature of water 400 feet below the surface of the earth to reduce the need for supplemental heating and air conditioning. So consequently, you have an energy-efficient building. And it has a terrazzo floor, which you would think would be new terrazzo tile, that is made from recycled mirrors and glass rather than traditional granite and marble. And you can't tell the difference. I've been there, looked at it. I was there for the dedication. And that's just a couple, three of the kind of highlights. The same kinds of practices were used on the Interstate 95 rest area we just opened up in the Fredericksburg district, where in fact they salvaged the existing concrete So we didn't tear up all the concrete entrances and exits. We used it. George Romack, by the way, has his initials in one of the concrete slabs. So if you when you see George again, he's here. He'll take you and show you where he put his initials in that slab in 1964, I think is the year that he did it. And so they'll be there for another 60 years. He's really proud of that. But, you know, I'm really proud of this rest area program. I know it was a priority of the board, and I know you're starting to see it really bear its fruition throughout the Commonwealth.
Mr. Chairman, once again, I have to express, as the district representative, my appreciation for not only the outstanding job, but the outstanding leadership that they've demonstrated to show that, you know, being green and being good and being effective all work compatibly well together, and this sets a whole new standard for VDOT to pursue in the future. It's just terrific.
Last two that I've got now go to the next piece that I really care about, and that's our workforce. And how do we demonstrate that changing workforce, that work ethic, the sense of public service that comes with a productive workforce that we have here in the Commonwealth? First individual I'm going to ask to stand up is Langston T. Williams. He's really LT if you know him. All right, there you go. He got a Governor's Award for Safety in the Workplace. He was recognized by the Commissioner for our achievement in workforce. And his demonstration and the reason he got the award is not just because of what he did, but because he wouldn't take no for an answer. He is one of the most tenacious individuals you will ever come across. When he found a problem, and I'll just brief it to you this way. He works in the Stanton District. And one of our tractors out there caught fire while stored overnight. And that created a hazard, because we have those tractors all over the Commonwealth, for all VDOT equipment shops. He determined the cause of the fire. An electrical cable that rubbed against a steering hose, so it was a design defect in the tractor. Not only did he take initiative to take care of our fleet, make sure that we did corrective action, but he also took on the company. So they got a worldwide change in the specification for that piece of equipment. By doing that, obviously, he did get us a new tractor and saved us $36,000 in the deal. But that shows you the kind of tenacity and attention to safety in the workplace that just is critical to a productive workforce. I got to know LT a lot last year. Once he gets a hold of you, he's like Jake. He's going to convert you. It's really cool. LT, thank you. And then the last workforce piece I wanted to highlight is one that you've heard about before, but I couldn't let it pass another opportunity to talk to you about it. The VDOT Wounded Veteran Internship Program, which you know has been recognized by the Federal Highway Administration for their Strive for Excellence Award, and what that program accomplishes in terms of transitioning veterans coming back to the United States and having a place to start. I had a chance to have dinner last night with Rick Kapka from the Federal Highway Administration. We're doing another event on the 26th of January in Fredericksburg to try to help get that program spread across the country. We were the first. We are the best. They have exceeded every goal. And all I can tell you is every place I go, I get nothing but compliments from the willingness of this Commonwealth to step up and help those people who have served our country and served our country well. So it's a real pleasure to have this team here and let you give them a round of applause one more time. Mr. Secretary, I really appreciate it. This is as fast as I can go through a topic, and believe me, I would have loved to have all 51 kinds of award winners here. And hopefully we can do this again for you, because it's exciting to do this kind of thing. And we appreciate the support that you give us in being able to do this. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Can I ask the board, let's give everybody a standing ovation for all the individuals and groups that are here. On behalf of the Commonwealth Transportation Board and Governor Kane, I would like to say thank you. As the governor says often, public service is a calling. And these are just such great examples of that calling. The other side of it, too, is public service is fun. And we see a smile on everyone's face. It's important to enjoy what we do, because we do well what we enjoy. And thank you again for not only doing a great job, but enjoying what you do. Thank you. The next item on our agenda will be our legislative and budget update, which is timely given the General Assembly's visit here. And presenting will be Deputy Secretary Barbara Reese, and Nick Donahue may be here to answer any substantive legislative questions, as well as Joanne Maxwell from the Attorney General's office. Welcome, Ms. Reese.
Good afternoon. Rather than speaking from the presentation that I believe was sent, I emailed it to all of you either late last week or early this week. This is the second in a series of presentations the Secretary has made to the various General Assembly members. This one incorporates some of the budget items that are included, and I put three pieces of information at your desk. The first one is a document that says at the top, Secretary of Transportation General Assembly Category Report. And then there's another one that is a written document, which is just referred to as transportation. And lastly, it is the actual pages out of the governor's budget proposal on transportation. So those are the three things I'll work from. And then if you have questions about anything, I'll be happy to talk about those. As the Secretary mentioned, we have been in session now. The General Assembly has been in session, I guess it's a week. We have any number of bills. The largest category of bills we have thus far are appealing the abuse of driver fee. Those bills have a revenue impact, in addition to what we've already briefed you on in December, of about $385 million. We do have two legislators who have offered to repeal those abuse of driver fees, but then replace the lost revenues with either a gas tax increase or a sales tax increase. If you turn on the first page of this report, you'll see there are 17 bills which are referred to as the Secretary's bills. Those bills are bills that were introduced by the administration that we are hopeful will be successful through the session. In the most part, most of those are either technical cleanup bills, or they are bills that deal with some form of safety or some kind of regulatory requirement. The only revenue fee increase bill that the governor submitted is the last one on that page, Senate Bill 512. Senator Von Miller, who is our new chairman of the Senate Transportation Committee, is the patron of that bill, and it does increase the driver's license fee from $20 to $30 for a five-year period, or $2 a year. And if you would note in that presentation that I sent you, DMV was the agency that really wasn't addressed last year in terms of funding, and this is a way of getting them about $14 million a year in funding. Their long-term funding need, based on their latest spending and estimates, is about $20 million a year. And so there's some other minor revenue changes that I can talk about in the budget for them. But bottom line is that bill is meant to try to get them some stability to their financial picture. Again, on page two.
Question, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Reese, what is House Bill 1301 on page one?
The bridge replacement and repair CTB powers, that simply adds bridge replacement and repair as a category of design bill, so that for many of the small bridges, Commissioner Eckern has an initiative to try to address a lot of the smaller bridges around the state, and that's a way to try to help facilitate that. Just as you were commenting on the great teamwork, it's a way of, to making sure that we can facilitate that activity.
Great. Thank you.
Pages 2, 3, and 4 are abusive driver bills. I'm not going to walk you through all those. Basically, they all say the same thing. In terms of land use, we are still seeing some bills dealing with land use or different components of land use, including development rights and impact fees, which is on page 7. And there's a couple other categories. So far, I do want to point out that all the bills have yet to be introduced. They can still introduce bills. I think it's through Friday of this week. So we're not done yet. The other category, we have not seen a tremendous number of bills, but we've seen some that have would have tremendous policy implication, which is on our PPTA program, where, for example, we had a bill introduced that would not allow us to look at doing hot lanes on 95-395. So that is one that we are working closely with the patron on and working to educate him on the whole use of our public-private program. On the bottom of page 9, there are 15 bills for those of you from Hampton Roads in Northern Virginia that in some form modify the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority or the Hampton Roads Transportation Authority. For Northern Virginia Transportation Authority, most of those the bills there are either technical cleanup bills or they may change the structure of the taxes and fees that can be imposed. For Hampton Roads, the bills run the gamut from repeal the Hampton Roads Transportation Authority to change their tax and fee structure to giving them additional powers. So there's a variety of bills there. There are four revenue sharing bills, two of which on the bottom of page 10, House Bill 111 and Senate Bill 99, which represent a compromise position that we were able to reach last year with the General Assembly about the revenue sharing program. And we are working with all the patrons of those bills to get to one bill for the rest of the session so that we can have it smooth, that subject go through the General Assembly smoothly. What it would do, the compromise bill would get rid of the $1 million requirement for match, but it still would require the priority setting so that if a local government said we'll invest $700,000, we're asking for $500,000 from the revenue sharing program, they would still receive a priority, but the highest priority would be local administration of the project. So we are working on that effort now. When that's pretty much, I guess, overall, all the ones that are the most significant. There are, beginning on the page 14, a number of transportation funding bills that change the allocation formula. To be honest, this is a much lower number than what we traditionally see each year. And bottom line is, without revenues to support any change in the formula, there are winners and losers. And most of the time, these bills decrease funding on the primary system, for example, to all the more rural districts and increase the funding in the more urban districts. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions about specific pieces of legislation. As the Secretary mentioned, Nick Donahue in our Office of the Assistant Secretary is the lead on keeping us organized on that, along with the great staff here at VDOT, Margaret Redford, and Keith Martin, and the Policy Director keeps us on top of things, but we can answer questions on any individual bill that you may have. Okay. And with that, I'll just briefly go through the budget. I would highly recommend this transportation summary you have, which is a written document. This is actually the document that the Senate Finance and House Appropriations Committee staff put together jointly every year at the beginning of the session to provide the overview of the governor's budget proposal. It's very well done. It's written in layman's terms, and it's short and sweet and to the point. You don't have to read through the arcaneness of budget language to understand it. So if you have a few minutes, you might want to read that. We really have made no significant proposals in terms of the Department of Rail and Public Transportation, or VDOT. In DRPT, the one area I will point out that is included, and it is on page 400 of the document that's the actual budget pages, paragraph E, and certainly Mr. Tucker can speak to this more. We have included language to try to work toward more public benefit and maintenance of effort activities for all the public transit and rail programs. That is something, as you know, we've tried to do systematically through the Rail Enhancement Fund, and we have offered language that would begin to lay out that process. The other significant item in Department of Rail and Public Transportation from a funding perspective is that there is language included in the governor's budget that would allow this board to authorize Mr. Tucker to have no more than 3% of a total project cost for project administration, compliance, and management out of his office. One of the things that's we've discovered is as you, particularly on the Rail Enhancement Fund projects where you have the intermodal site work being done, and then you have Norfolk Light Rail safety compliance and all these different activities, there is no source of funding for Mr. Tucker and the agency to bring in consultant support or help or to even pay for some additional resources there. So this is just language that gives them the authority to be able to have a way of funding for that kind of work. And the only other issue or item that's fairly new that we don't know how the General Assembly will react to it, we think positively from all indications, is on page, at the bottom of page 400, top of page 401, where we are putting some process and parameters and dates around the rail plan and moving forward to have passenger rail service in the 95 corridor as well as other corridors in Virginia. With that, I'll turn to VDOT. To be perfectly honest, there is no change of any significance in the VDOT language in the budget. The numbers for the various programs are based on House Bill 3202 and on the items that you were briefed on in December, but we've taken on no new initiatives or anything in their budget. That is, it's fairly a stagnant budget for the most part. And with that, enjoy your afternoon.
Any questions of Ms. Reese? Mr. Coulomb.
One question. Barbara, we've read in the paper just this morning that the governor is hinting strongly that there may be a revenue re-estimate in February. Can you give us some indication on how that might affect transportation per se?
Well, what would two areas where we would have the greatest concerns and are the two areas that will likely, if there is a revenue, if there are signs that there needs to be a revenue reforecast, will happen are in recordation taxes, which are the new source of funding that is going to primarily to the public transportation program starting in July, was 2 cents of the recordation tax, as well as 1 cent of the recordation going to highway maintenance. So if those revenues turned down, there will be a decrease in those items. The second area is the sales and use tax. One of the things that we forget is that the Transportation Trust Fund receives 0.5% of that sales and use tax revenue. So when you hear about declining sales, December sales information came out and it was abysmal. If there is, that would be another area likely that would be down. The other thing is we all have to recognize as gas goes over $3 or hovers around $3 a gallon, our tax is not based on a percentage. It is a percent as people drive less or adjust to try to deal with that higher gas prices and energy prices overall. I know I got my first heating bill for the year, and it was not a pleasant experience. That we expect that those revenues will continue to be shaky. We've already lost, if you recall from December, $400 million out of the revenue estimate for the 6 years based on a weakening economy. But we'll keep you informed as we know.
Okay, any other questions of Ms. Reese? I would add the starting point right now for reductions in the existing 6-year program is $400 million. If the abusive driving fees are eliminated by the General Assembly and agreed to by the governor, that's about another $400 million. If there are federal rescissions, remember the Federal Highway Trust Fund is also in a deficit posture, the numbers, the reductions could continue to grow. And that's based on the current revenue estimates.
Maybe this is not a
the topic of losing the money from the abuser's possibility of having our six-year budget reduced by that 385. There are a number of ideas floating about. Is the administration optimistic that that gap might be filled, or it really is the will of the General Assembly, or how to? Is there anything we can do?
The governor has said that he is open to revenue replacements, particularly on a larger scale. Mm-hmm. In April, when he did reach a compromise on House Bill 3202, acknowledged the gap in maintenance funding.
Yes.
Was the largest single piece of business before the General Assembly and was not fully addressed by any stretch of the imagination. So there was last April an identified gap of about $260 million annually, but that's the gap between the amount that is transferred out of construction and into maintenance on an annual basis. That number, as we all know, grows a little bit or a lot, depending upon your perspective, each and every year. So that dynamic is still with us. The elimination of the abusive driving fees just exacerbates that trend. Okay. I would also, while Mr. Donahue's coming up, there is a something at your places, which is a 2007 accomplishments and goals. You received a copy of this electronically. This has been briefed to the two transportation committees and the two transportation subcommittees. In 2007, it's worth going back, just like the commissioner did with some of the awards, that look at some of the significant progress that occurred programmatically in terms of business practices, in terms of projects, in terms of programs. There are also a list of some goals for the upcoming year. Some of those are project-oriented, some of them are program-oriented. There's also a list of challenges. Some of those challenges are financial, but by far our biggest challenge is highway safety. And we did cross a very terrible threshold this year. And we, as Commonwealth Transportation Board, have an obligation to respond to that challenge of over 1,000 fatalities this year. And we'll be talking about that at each and every meeting of the Commonwealth Transportation Board this coming year. The next item on our agenda is the secondary street acceptance regulations. This is a periodic update from Mr. Donahue. Welcome, Mr. Donahue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nick Donahue, and I'm here to provide the board with an update on the development of the secondary street acceptance requirements. As a reminder, this initiative is a result of legislation that was proposed by Governor Plains in the 2007 General Assembly session. It was unanimously passed by the General Assembly. And the intent of this initiative is to ensure that streets accepted for VDOT for perpetual public maintenance provide a public benefit. The enabling legislation includes several mandatory provisions. It states that the regulation shall include provisions to ensure the connectivity of road and pedestrian networks, provisions to address performance bonding and other cost recovery mechanisms, and provisions to minimize stormwater runoff and reduce impervious surface area through reduced street widths. The Secretary has impaneled an implementation advisory committee, which consists of representatives from the development, local government community, and other stakeholders. This committee has met 5 times to review and refine the draft regulation. In addition to this committee, there is a VDOT technical committee that consists of district representatives as well as central office staff that has been meeting throughout this process and will continue to meet to address the technical issues of this regulation. I'd like to share with the board a tentative timeline that we have sketched out for the development of this regulation and welcome any comments you all have on this timeline. Currently, we have ongoing outreach with several localities and look to expand that outreach. And we also have outreach with several developers. I believe tomorrow, VDOT staff will be meeting with members of the Region 2000 MPO, as well as meeting with members from the Tazewell delegation with Mr. Keene. I've been in contact with many of our partners in the private sector, and we will continue that outreach and we will expand it as we move forward. After this outreach is conducted, we hope to publish the regulation for public comment either in February, March, or April, so we can hear from a wide community as well as just hear additional comments from those who we previously spoke with. After the public comment is solicited and a public hearing is held, it is our intent that the Implementation Advisory Committee will be reconvened to review these public comments and refine the draft regulation based on those public comments. After they have refined the regulation, we will reinitiate outreach with the localities and developers to get additional public comments. And after that, I anticipate that we would bring the regulation to the CTB for final action in late summer or fall of this year. And as we have stated throughout this process, we will continue to brief this body on the development of the regulation.
And Mr. Donahue, it's the clear understanding of staff that the publication of an initial draft regulation will not occur without review and discussion by the Commonwealth Transportation Board prior to publication for advertisement.
Certainly, and that was my mistake in not mentioning that fact. Thank you for clarifying that. There are several just key high-level points I'd like to hit with the board, and I believe one of the most important ones that we have not previously discussed is the vesting provisions. The regulation will recognize vested property rights and valid site plans, preliminary site plans, proffered rezonings, and subdivision plats that were approved prior to the effective date of this regulation may be accepted under former requirements. This is a very important issue, and I believe we can't administratively undo a vested property right which is granted in the code. Recognizing the diversity of the Commonwealth and the varying levels of development and the needs of the Commonwealth, as we have previously briefed the board, the regulation would recommend establishing three area types: compact, suburban, and rural. And these area types will be based on federal, regional, and local planning boundaries. The regulation also includes provisions that allow the local governing body to request a modification of the area type if they believe that it may not be appropriate. And this would be in areas, where the comprehensive plan designates 10-acre lots and it's out in the western part of Loudoun. Perhaps that shouldn't be in a certain area type and the local governing body could request a change. The connectivity requirements is one of the mandatory provisions of this regulation, and I believe it's the real meat of this regulation. So I would like to just discuss some of the benefits of connectivity. By having connected local street network, we can help keep the local trips off of the regional network. In many areas of the state where developments have one way in and one way out, short local trips that otherwise could take place on local roads are forced out into the regional transportation network, which causes problems both for those local travelers as well as the through regional traffic. By improving this connectivity, we can help reduce some of the trips that utilize the regional transportation network and improve emergency response times, providing more direct access. The connectivity requirements that are in the proposed regulation, the draft regulation, vary based on area type. The link node ratio requirement, and if the board will recall, a link is a segment of street that exists or a stub out or a cul-de-sac, and a node is the end of a cul-de-sac or the intersection of several streets. And the link node ratio requirement that is proposed for compact area types is 1.6 or higher. And I would like to remind the board that the compact area type is generally, in the way it is laid out, will be in areas where higher growth is anticipated to take place, such as urban development areas, transport development right receiving areas, and other areas of infill development. There's also a requirement for external connectivity, and that requirement would be one external connection as well as an additional external connection stub out for every 50 links within a network addition. Network additions within the suburban area type would need to have a link node ratio of 1.4 or above, as well as and have the same external connectivity that is required in the compact area type. In the rural areas, there is no link node ratio requirement recognizing the level of development and topography that tends to exist. There's only connection for external connectivity. And I understand that looking at 1.6 and 1.4 really can be hard to understand without seeing that in context. So here are just several examples of link node ratios I wanted to share with the board. If you look at the image on the top left there, that's a grid street network. It is a link node ratio of over 2.5, which is generally the peak that can be reached for link node ratios. And then if you look at the graphic in the middle, That is an example of a development that has a lint node ratio of 1. That is the lowest lint node ratio that can be achieved, assuming that the streets connect to other streets. The graphic below the grid street system shows an example of a network addition that would meet the proposed compact area lint node ratio requirements. And then the graphic on the far right there shows an example of a network addition that would meet the proposed suburban area type network addition requirements. One thing I want to stress to the board is that these connectivity requirements are not absolutes. We understand that there will be instances and circumstances where these provisions cannot be met, and there will be exceptions in the draft regulation. Currently, there are exceptions for incompatible land use, such as detached single-family housings next to a factory. In those instances, the external connectivity requirements would be waived. The requirements could also be waived when terrain such as mountains, rivers, or other physical impedances such as a limited access highway would make it difficult, if not impossible, to meet the connectivity requirements.
Mr. Donahue, who would determine whether a particular project would qualify for these exceptions?
The district administrator or his designee, as the regulation is currently drafted. And another thing I want to stress with the board that I failed to mention in my previous presentations, and I apologize for that, the connectivity requirements will not apply to rural addition roads or industrial or economic access roads. Those roads will continue to be governed by the same criteria that governs their acceptance into the system today. Another provision in the draft regulation is conditional acceptance. Where, if allowed by a locality, a developer may choose to meet their lint node ratio requirement through the use of stub outs. And this would be a situation where the developer relies on reduced internal connectivity for the promise of future external connectivity greater than that which is required by the regulation. However, this process does carry the risk that if for some reason, either through local action or other actions, the stub outs were not connected, the streets would be removed from the state system after 1 year. And another thing I'd like to stress is these provisions would not apply to the majority of subdivisions and do not apply to stub outs that are required to meet the external connectivity requirements. The second mandatory provision of the legislation is, or another mandatory provision, excuse me, of the legislation is the requirement for pedestrian connectivity. In compact area types, which, as I mentioned earlier, areas where we, based on their planning designations, we anticipate dense growth, sidewalks will be required along both sides of the street. In suburban areas, developers will have several options. They may either provide sidewalks along both sides of the streets, or they may use a system of trails and sidewalks, which provides general pedestrian mobility and accessibility throughout the development. And in certain areas in the suburban area type where the developments have lots that are generally 2 acres or larger, they may provide a sidewalk along one side of the street or just a system of trails. In rural area types, the draft regulation proposes that a system of trails or sidewalk along one side of the street would be acceptable. However, on streets where the annual daily traffic is anticipated to be 200 vehicles or less, the pedestrian accommodation requirements would be waived. The last mandatory provision of the legislation that is to address performance bonding and other cost recovery requirements. The performance bonding has been increased in the draft regulation from $2,000 per tenth of lane mile to $3,000 per tenth of lane mile. And this increase is based on the increase in highway construction CPI, which since the development of the former requirements has gone up somewhere around 40%, I do believe.
Mr. Chairman. The last issue, just before the surety, you were talking about 200 cars per day.
Yes, sir.
How was that chosen? Because a lot of rural roads that I'm familiar with, 300 cars a day is very common, very rural roads. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose 200?
The reason we chose this number is if you recall, the traffic impact analysis regulations, this body, as well as VDOT, established several measures of pedestrian quality of service. And so using several of the methodologies that are in that regulation, we evaluated various street conditions, for traffic to see where the level of service or quality of service at sea could be achieved, and generally based on an aggregate of those analysis of 200 vehicles per day is what was chosen.
Because I'm familiar with a lot of unpaved roads out in the area that have 300 cars a day. I would see no reason in the world to put a sidewalk along those unpaved roads. It just seems like it's an unreasonably low number to me. And I just wondered if there was a basis for choosing the 200 as opposed to 500. Because even 500 a day, if you break it up over a 24-hour period, that's what you do, isn't it, 24 hours?
Yes, sir.
That's still not very much traffic.
Well, and we do understand your concerns. We will revisit this issue and do some additional analysis. This number was just, as I said, chosen based on with the goal of providing an adequate quality of service for the pedestrians in those areas. Mr. Schwartz?
I just want to understand something about compact area types. Is it correct that compact area types can exist, be identified and exist in rural areas, for example, as towns and villages in rural areas where, even though you may have overall a rural county, the compact area type requirements would apply?
That is accurate. There is flexibility in the area type designations that would allow a local governing body to designate any area within their locality to apply to either suburban or compact area types if we're in a rural area type. And there are also provisions that if there's a town or other growth area designated within the comprehensive plan, that those areas would either fall into a suburban or compact area type as opposed to the rural area type.
Thank you.
So, for example, Warrington and Fauquier County would fall into the compact area.
Mr. Dickens.
Mr. Chair, briefly, how do you plan to coordinate these rules with the local government rules and regulations?
Well, I would say that first, we'll need to have continued outreach with the local governments to discuss what is proposed for the area types as well as the requirements. But after that, I would believe that the residency administrators and the local governing bodies could work together to identify the areas that would be affected based on local planning decisions. And I would imagine that the changes wouldn't be something that would occur overnight, but rather be something that would be updated every year or several years.
Okay. Mr. McCarthy.
Should I ask now or wait till he finishes the last page or two?
Fire away.
I assume that many of us sent you comments back in mid-December when you had asked for them. I know I did. What happens with those? Like, I had several questions and comments, and I don't recall getting a response.
I apologize. I do not believe I received comments from Mr. McCarthy. However, I will go back and see if I may have overlooked those and will provide you with responses to any questions you may have raised.
Well, you could look for December 12th at 10 a.m.
As I said, I apologize if I failed to respond to you. That was an oversight on my part, and I will respond to you by the end of the week.
Ms. McCarthy, if you have a copy of that, you might want to leave that with Mr. Donahue today.
Maybe.
Any other questions on that page? Okay.
As I was saying, the performance bonding requirements have been increased to reflect the inflation and highway cost. And the length of the surety varies based on the type of inspection process that is used. For example, if a developer relies on a local certification process, such as the one that exists in Prince William County, the surety would be completely waived. If a developer relied on the normal standard VDOT inspection process, which is a less robust inspection process than some of the other alternatives that are provided in the regulation, the surety would need to exist for 3 years. The regulation also increases the administrative cost recovery fee from $2,500 per tenth of a two-lane roadway to $3,000. And this increase is based on a study that the Virginia Transportation Research Council conducted during 2006 and 2007, where it examined the cost of VDOT's land development activities and that it was determined that the current costs were far below what was necessary to recover VDOT's expenses. And the regulation also includes a $1,500 per lane mile inspection fee to help VDOT recover its cost of inspecting these roadways prior to acceptance into the system. Several other provisions that are in the regulation. The regulation contains a defined appeals process with set time frames for VDOT response. The regulation will also the subdivision street design guide will also contain street widths that vary based on whether or not there's on-the-street parking or off-street parking. Another change in the regulation is that stormwater management facilities will be allowed within the VDOT right-of-way, provided an agreement is signed with the locality that absolves VDOT of any liability. And there's also provision in the regulation that says all parties shall take steps to minimize the impact of cut-through traffic.
With your permission, Mr. Chair, what would be examples of steps that could minimize the impact of cut-through traffic?
Several examples would be basing the street width on whether or not there is on-street parking. In a lot of instances, a street will be built 36 or 40 feet wide to accommodate on-the-street parking. However, every house that is on that segment of street has a two-car garage way as well as a garage, as well as a driveway, which can easily accommodate another four or five vehicles. So what you've ended up with is a situation where very few people ever park on the street, and you have a street that is wider than some would say is necessary, so drivers who are on those streets feel more comfortable traveling at higher speeds, which can, one, residents generally don't like higher speeds in front of their houses, and can also create conflicts with kids playing in the street. And
Mr. Martin, I think one of the that's traditional traffic calming, so it might be narrower streets, it might be speed humps, it could be traffic circles. I mean, there are a variety of techniques that are employed today in neighborhoods throughout the Commonwealth. So,
and with that, I'd be happy to entertain any questions the board may have.
Official vote on this is when?
Well, or is that we have the board done? Has to authorize at some point in spring or summer a draft regulation for publication, and that is subject then to public comment. And then the current schedule calls for summer fall adoption based on that public commentary.
Mr. Chairman, let me extend thanks to Nick and you and the staff for taking into consideration concerns that I had when we were in Roanoke, addressing some of those concerns, and the fact that we will now have counties and local governments involved more apparent as a result of your action. Thanks for that, and maybe we'll have a better document as a result of it.
Thank you. Mr. White.
Mr. Chairman, let me chime in as well with thanks, because there has been a considerable amount of concern in my district about these proposed regulations, and the staff has been very quick in an outreach effort to one of the local MPOs, and perhaps there will be another one that will want to have a presentation, but he made reference to the fact there will be a presentation tomorrow afternoon in Lynchburg to that MPO. And for those board members who have not availed themselves of that resource, that will be a great way. I'm looking forward to getting a lot of local feedback from that session. So I would encourage you to contact the staff if you'd like those kind of presentations in your district. And thank you very much for providing that service.
I have one. Ms. Card.
Go back to the fee of $3,000, I believe that's what it is, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
And that's a fee that doesn't exist at all now, right?
No, this fee does exist today. It's $2,000 per tenth of lane mile, and we're increasing it based on the increase in highway construction CPI.
And who pays for this?
This would be a bond that the developer would take.
I know that. The reason I ask that is because, of course, that's passed on to the homeowner. And you have nothing to do with that. That's okay. You're doing your job, and I appreciate what you've done. But, it's just a concern of how much more we create and how much more we do to pass on to a homeowner who cannot afford homes at this present time. And that's my concern that I have tremendously.
And we do understand those concerns, and that's why one of the things we've sought to do in this regulation is provide several alternatives to surety, such as utilizing the local certification process or other means that are spelled out in the regulation, which in those instances, the surety would be waived or reduced.
Mr. Dickens.
Would you go back to the slide with the grid pattern on it? I'm not sure I understand the external connector. If I remember correctly, your description said one external connector. And do I understand that external connector not being the exit from the subdivision to the main street, but to an adjacent subdivision? Am I right or wrong there? Straighten me out, please.
I believe you may have a little bit of a misunderstanding. What the intent for that provision was is that for every network addition, there would be at least one external connection. And then in addition to that, there'd be a second external connection as well as a stub out. And as the size of the network addition increased, so would the requirements for the external connectivity. So say if your development, which had 100 links, which is a very substantial size development, it would need to have 4 external connections and 2 stub outs. Or if it saw fit, 6 external connections.
Well, then is the stub out the connection to the adjacent neighborhood?
And depending on whether or not this is infill development or greenfield and the conditions that exist around it, the stub out could be that site for future connection to the adjoining parcel, or that external connection could be to a stub out that exists on a parcel that was already developed.
Well, where I'm headed with all this is I'm concerned that the external connections are putting everybody in the neighborhood back out on the main road and not providing opportunities for people to go to adjacent neighborhoods or businesses or whatever without getting back out on the major road. Am I missing something here?
Well, and that would be at the discretion of the developer. However, the hope and intent would be that some of these connections would be on the main roads and then other connections would be with other local roads. However, we didn't think it would be appropriate to put in very restrictive requirements stating that one of these connections must be on another roadway designated as local, just because that would put in another appeals or exceptions process and might, you know, create conflict with certain conditions on the ground.
Dean?
Somebody correct me if my memory is faulting. One of the first things I remember when I came on the board was we set up a mandate to consider bicycle accommodation with new construction, and if that is correct, would we want to make the same expectation of developers, or is that covered under pedestrian accommodations?
I believe the way the regulation is written, it does reference the CTV policy that was adopted in 2004 and then spells out some additional guidance that builds upon that policy.
Okay, so that would be in the fine print, in the text. That we don't, okay.
Yes, sir.
Mr. McCarthy.
Nick, we had a case in Richmond not so long ago where a developer wanted to do the right thing according to this. It's not adopted yet, but they were going to have connectivity within the subdivision and then an external whatever that was going to connect to an adjacent existing subdivision, which seemed like a good idea on paper until the existing subdivision found out about it.
Absolutely.
How do you deal with that in these regulations? Because that would be an external link from a proposed one, but it would be going someplace where it might not be wanted by the adjacent subdivision. And yet, I'm not even sure what my question is here.
But we see, we
McCarthy,
understand.
See the problem?
Yeah. Mr. McCarthy, I think the issue is those are what are known as interparcel connectors, and they may or may not be an external connection, as Mr. Donahue was talking about. Those are a requirement today. However, they may be waived by local governing bodies. And the issue here, and this, you're right, this will generate local controversy, and some of our newly elected members are going to experience this pain firsthand. But if there is not connectivity, you're pushing the traffic out onto the main street. That's one of the major objectives of these regulations. And one of my observations, having worked for many years in those wonderful vineyards of local government, is if they say my hands are tied, I have to approve these, it is not, today it is not a strong requirement.
Because of the McCarthy Amendment.
It does indeed create, in some cases, that citizen opposition.
Mr. Chairman, don't I understand, though, from the regulations, if the first community does not accept that, they lose their, the roads come out of the system?
If I may answer that one, Mr. Chairman. That situation would only exist if the initial development that was put in place chose to use stub outs to meet their link node ratio requirement. And in that instance, they would first have to receive approval from the local governing body to do so.
But if they use stub outs, that's what the new development would be tying into, wouldn't it?
Yes, sir.
So the only way the new development would tie into an existing is if the existing had stub outs, which were approved. Therefore, back to the question, if the existing doesn't, you know, they've got a stub out, but they don't want the new neighborhood to connect into them, do they lose their streets? Do those streets come out of the system?
Only if the initial development, if you look at some of the examples up here, mm-hmm. assume we are in the suburban area type, so if you look at the graphic on the far mm-hmm. right there, only if we took out, if that internal street network had reduced, if some of those links were missing and there were more cul-de-sacs in that initial one, and to make up for the presence of those cul-de-sacs, additional stub-outs were provided, only in that instance would the conditional acceptance apply. All the examples you see here, even if they had stub-outs and those stub-outs were never connected to, they would continue to remain in the system.
Mr. Coolman.
One final comment, Mr. Chairman. We struggle in Northern Virginia constantly with what I call the fallacy of cut-through traffic. The fact is, on a public facility, it can't be cut through traffic because it's a public facility. And that's what we all need to understand, is that our protection of the system really is our top priority here. I mean, there's others who will argue the protection of the neighborhoods and the protection of individual streets. But I would like to even see that removed from your nomenclature and presentation and so forth. The idea of cut-through traffic is a set of assumptions that may or may not exist. It's not cut-through traffic if a fire truck's trying to get to a home on fire, for example. And I understand people own their neighborhoods, but in fact, if these are going to be public streets maintained by the state, we need to make sure that that's understood as a primary objective, not as a secondary.
And I'd like to agree with Mr. Colomay and what you said earlier. This whole thing is about trying to help keep traffic off of the major streets, and if we water it down to a point where we're not strongly encouraging the connectivity between neighborhoods, we've not really accomplished a whole lot. So I would support as making it as strong as we can to encourage that sort of positive behavior.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Mr. Donahue, is there an actual revised draft of the regulations that's the basis for the presentation today?
I'm currently churning the latest draft. The General Assembly has slowed my progress slightly. However, I anticipate I could probably finish one over the weekend.
Okay. Again, I don't think it's necessarily that urgent, but this is an iterative process, and every time we are able to focus collective wisdom on that and provide informed comments. This is such a diverse state, and what works in Bristol probably doesn't work on the Eastern Shore. And so that's the challenge of writing a regulation like this, and where your valued input, advice, and guidance, again, given the regional diversity of this group, is so very important. So if you would please send that out once again, and when you do that, you make that available to the policy committee and to other folks who are involved in the drafting process. It is, in effect, a public document, correct?
Yes, sir, and I will do that.
Mr. Schwartz.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nick, I just wanted to say that I really do appreciate what you're doing on this, and I think we all recognize that when you break new ground like this, it's very, very difficult, not only in terms of trying to address in advance so many of the issues, but we also recognize that inevitably when these regulations get adopted, circumstances will come up subsequently where we'll look at them and we'll say, oops, we need to refine it in one way or another. And so echoing the chairman's comments, it'll be an iterative process not only between now and the time we adopt the regulations, but subsequently as well. and there'll be no lack of comments and criticisms, I'm sure, even after they're adopted. But I do want to thank you for the hard work you're doing on this.
Thank you.
Good job.
Well said.
Okay, if there, Mr. Donahue.
And one thing I would just like to inform or let the board know is Delaware has recently revised their street standards and have attempted to address some of the same issues and have some of the same goals that our initiative has. And they actually use link node ratio to measure connectivity throughout their state. So I just wanted to let the board know that. And if you would like, I could send a copy of those regulations along to you all.
Will that reduce the toll on the Delaware Bridge?
I don't believe so.
That's a three-county state.
They'll be so busy circling around in their internal street system, they won't.
Okay. Any other where's final questions or comments? Ms. Donahue, thank you. This is a Herculean task, and we do appreciate your outreach efforts and the great staff work. Commissioner, as well, you've been devoting a lot of internal resources to this, and I think this is to the point where, again, I know you have this underway, but so that folks understand, the individual districts are starting to pull this apart. I think there's a good framework here where some of the major issues have been resolved, and it's important to view these through the prism of individual regions and understand their impacts, identify problems. Some can be fixed, some not. That's just the regulatory process. Ms. Carter.
Nick, I know that you have met with some people who disagree with you, but they have really given you excellent compliments of your work. And so I appreciate that very much.
Thank you for passing those comments along.
Thank you, Nick. The next item on the agenda, number 4, is the BRIT Trans 2035. Ooh. We've advanced from 2025. Moving the vision forward, Deputy Secretary Ralph Davis will be presenting. Welcome, Mr. Davis.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm handing out VTrans 2025. There's a lot of discussion in my presentation on VTrans 2025. About six of you were involved in on a panel several years ago to do VTrans 2025, and to get those of you who were not engaged in that process. I can get this.
If that's the point of your head.
I think they're so popular we've run out.
Could we get Mrs. Conley to autograph this session?
Is that
this book? She's the chair.
I don't think
she's in here.
You're required in law to do a long-range plan every 5 years. There's also a co-provision which requires the Office of Intermodal Planning and Investment to assist you in doing a long-range plan, and I'm the Office of Intermodal Planning and Investment. So my charge today is to work with you in terms of developing your long-range, next round long-range transportation plan. One of the things I wanted to do was briefly talk a little bit about VTrans 2025. And in the document I just handed out, if you would turn to page 13, I'll run through a couple of these things. We did VTrans 2025, and we have lots of results. We go to page, and I'm not going to go through these in detail. But if you look at page 13 of this document, it talks about recommendations. One of those recommendations dealt with land use. And if you look at the bottom, what it said was address transportation land use conflict. The General Assembly should address the conflict that arises from the separation of authority for transportation land use. That's what we were saying back in 2002-2004. What has happened? We've seen some results as a result of the recommendations that you made. Connectivity, it said think multimodally. We're still working there. That's where we still need to continue to make improvements. We're not quite there. Priority setting, I'm going to look on page 14. It says plan multimodally. Use objective criteria. We're making progress in that area as well. Other kinds of things in here, one of the major recommendations was that we needed a substantial investment in transportation. That was made by you back in 2004. And as a result of that, we've seen significant investment in transportation. Transportation plans normally don't have a very good, very long shelf span. But I think with VTrans 2025, we have seen results from the recommendations that you have made. Hopefully with VTrans 2035, we will see something very similar. Background, we established a vision. And that vision was we wanted a safe, strategic, and seamless transportation system. I will not go through these, but I think it's important that we talk about vision and goals, that we continue to talk about that same vision and goals. And I think if I say it often enough, 4 or 5 years, just keep saying the same safe, strategic, and seamless, that sooner or later we believe it. The thing about a vision is it's not something that we can accomplish in 1 or 2 or 3 years. If we want a safe, strategic, and seamless transportation system, that's something fairly far out. And one of the things you can see in this presentation is the theme is moving the vision forward. And what that is we cannot achieve that particular vision in now 2, 3, 4 years since the plan was last done. It's really long-term kind of thing. So that's sort of the theme of this whole presentation is that we need to, for VTrans 2035, is that we need to move the vision forward. More background, again, I won't go through all of this. The board did adopt the plan long-range goals back in 2004. One of the things that happened with VTrans 2025 was that we were reviewed by the Georgia Legislative Audit Review Commission. And that was a day of relief for me, because they kind of put the gold seal of this such a thing. When JLOC comes out and says your methodology and your numbers and so forth are reasonable, which is what they said, it kind of gave credence to all the work that we've done for 3 to 4 years. And that they said the methodology, the numbers, we had some big numbers in this report in terms of what the needs were. And JLOC reviewed it and said the methodology and numbers were reasonable. On the other side, in 2005, the APA looked at what we had done and said we still lacked a coordinated transportation plan. And we had worked 4 years trying to coordinate. We still have stovepipe planning. We have transit, we have roads, we have airports, we have ports. That's part of this seamless, so that's where we need to get. We're not quite there yet. Another plus is that when I started this thing in 2002 with then Governor Warner, one of the challenges was to Governor Warner is, do I talk at all about revenues? Because I came out of an environment where you just could not talk about revenue needs and transportation. You just would not talk about it. And I was hesitant in talking to Governor Warner about having some revenue or comparing revenue and needs. Over time, we were able to talk about it, and eventually the numbers that we had kind of framed the debate in terms of being able to talk about transportation and revenue needs and the need for investment in transportation. It played a very big role in that. The approach, as I said, is moving the vision forward. What we want to do is not repeat VTrans 2025, but we want to expand on it. We need to continue to work on unifying the highway, rail, and transit plans. We need to integrate the MPO plans. There are 14 MPOs out there. We have not successfully, and all the plans are different, and there are separate rural plans that VDOT does. Some of what we need to do in this next plan is do a better job at integrating those MPO, those rural plans, into the overall state plan. That's some of what we want to do this time, which we didn't do last time. We need to think long term. As I've thought about this thing over the last several months, a year, is that VTrans 2025 turns out to be, the numbers are 20 years, but the policies and kind of things we're talking about are really more like 3 to 5 years. Most of what we have in V-Trans 2025, we have done. What we need to do in V-Trans 2035 is, what does transportation, what do we think it looks like 20, 30 years out? Not 5 years, but what do we think? And perhaps we need some thought leaders, and you of us, with you and others, to think, transportation 2035, what does it look like? One way is, think backcast. What did it look like 20 years ago? What will it look like 2035? I don't know, but some of what we want to do in this process, one of the elements on here, you can see at the bottom bullet, is a futurist element. I'm looking at some kind of thing, a visioning kind of session where we get some of the thought leaders. So we can start thinking about 2035, what does transportation in Virginia look like? I don't have a good idea, but there are a lot of people a lot smaller than I am who could probably help us envisioning Virginia transportation 2035. Moving the vision forward, I'm looking at a series of technical reports, and one of those technical reports would be the V-Trans accomplishments. We need to go back, much like I did the two-second look at accomplishments, but I'd like a detailed look at what did you say you were going to do, and did you do it? What have you actually accomplished? And I think there are a number of accomplishments, and one of the things I'd like to do, another pops in my head, is we talked about a separate rail funding stream. You talk about additional funding for transit. All this stuff were things that the U.S. Policy Committee recommended that actually happened. And so we want to go back and revisit that. Long-term viability of fuel stacks. We are about multimodal. We're about choices. We're about bike riding, transit, all other kinds of things that are non-highway centric. If it's non-highway centric, highway fund depends on the fuel stacks. So what we want you to do is do those kind of things that say you don't drive your car. Result is, as you look further and further out, not only are we moving to different choices and not using that car, but the efficiency of the vehicle stock is changing. We're talking about electric vehicles. We're talking about alternative fuel types of vehicles. So what that means is our core source of revenue as you look further and further out will be declining. So as we know that, what do we need to do about it? What I'm suggesting here is we not wait until the Oregon mileage fee study is done. Why doesn't Virginia get ahead of it? Why don't we start thinking about that seriously now? There's a subcommittee that Pierce is on that deals with fuel efficient vehicles and transportation funding. I think USCTB should be ahead of that. Understand what is happening to your core source of funding. We need to look at what other national and state kinds of studies. But essentially, our core source of funding gas tax based on gallons, over long term, flat to declining. We need some options. What are the options? And not wait till the Oregon study results are for 2030, 2035, and essentially has instruments within cars. You need similar kind of instruments on the fuel, on the gas tanks, and what you're doing is recording mileage. That's a very difficult, very costly process, and my review of the Oregon study says that's 2030. We can have issues far before 2030, and we need to think about other ways of dealing with our core source of funding, and that needs to be a near term. We need to be making recommendations in the near term in terms of how do we deal with the fact that core source of funding will be declining over a long period of time. There are a couple pieces in this proposal that I call signature pieces. And one of those is the economic impact of transportation investment. I worked on the Transportation Accountability Commission. One of the things they kept saying is, how can you continue to ask for money? You keep talking about your needs. What are we getting in return? So one of the ways to deal with that is to say, let's do an economic impact of transportation investment. So we can say, each dollar you invest in transportation, this is what it means in terms of gross state product, or in terms of earnings, or in terms of employment, and so forth. So this would be a study that we would do that doesn't currently exist. Matt's probably have done some. There's some done for aviation. There's one similar done for the port. But there's not one done for overall transportation. So the idea here is we do a study, have a commission, a study, that gets at what is the economic impact of your dollar invested in transportation. You can talk about direct benefits, indirect benefits, return on each dollar invested. And this is something we haven't done. We didn't do in VTrans 2025. We'd like to see done for VTrans 2035. As I'm going through this, this is not my long-range study, it's your study. And I'm looking for feedback and input from you in terms of if something is missing out of here, or something should be taken out, or added. I'd like your input in terms of what that should be. In VTrans 2025, we started something called MENWIS, which was a multimodal investment network, a series of major corridors in the state. We'd like to pursue that a bit more this go route. Further identify those corridors, what kind of investments do we need in those corridors, and so forth. Those are a series of technical reports that have some dates in terms of when I think they would be coming out. The idea here is I will be coming forward before you on a periodic basis, updating you in terms of what we're doing and results. So there are some dates in terms of when we will be generating those reports. Other than technical reports, there will be a series of chapters in this VTrans document. We'll not necessarily go through all of those. You can see those. I provided them to you. There may be some additions here and there that I may need to make. For example, I have gotten some feedback from two of you on this. As you look at the changing socioeconomic trends and forecasts, one of the things we may need to do is add something in there on transit, carpooling, and so forth. How those things change, I'm sure Matt has all that. But some of this is really coordinating that process and making sure that it's not only about highways, but it's about those other modal entities as well. One of the other things I'll mention under the third bullet, we are required to do through the authorities, regional performance measures. Two authorities have to develop those measures and report them to you. We will be working with those authorities and coordinating that process. Next slide here. I think this is an opportunity for, again, a signature piece. What are the trends in safety? The Secretary mentioned the milestone this year in safety, 112 folks based on the latest piece of data. I've done a quick and dirty kind of analysis. Essentially, VMT, which is miles traveled, goes up by 2% a year. If we maintain the current level of fatalities per VMT, we're talking 2035, probably 1,700 to 2,000 folks being killed on the highways. That's just, we don't do anything, and VMT continues to go up, essentially, and there are no changes in the rate relationship from VMT and fatalities. That continues to creep up. And some of what we're doing and some things that the Commissioner's done is we've got to put in place strategies and plans to deal with this number of fatalities. A lot of that may well not be things that we do. A lot of it may be technology involved in vehicles. Some of the reasons we've seen some decreases in fatalities is basically our vehicles are safer. We have seat belts. We have airbags and those kind of things that you didn't have back in the 70s. But we've got to think about what the trends are, what choices do we have, and what can we do about it. I will not go through each of those, but there are a series of trends and choices. And the idea there is to look at them, talk about what the trend is, and what we should be doing about those things as we move forward.
Mr. Chair, Ralph, I realize this is a framework document. But I think on the slide that you're on now, the trends and choices, I would suggest that we take regionalism and put it right up there under safety as a trend and a choice that needs to be analyzed and really examine and look at its potential impact not only on rural Virginia, but on the state as a whole. And if that's where we're going to end up with, you know, 9 or 10 regional transportation authorities out there at 2035, what's going to be the impact? It would appear that there isn't that will to step up and finance a statewide system from legislative revenue generation, so that they want to kick it out and, I guess, have other ways to generate revenue with different authorities, but I think that's going to be something that we really need to examine and try to look at the impact that's going to have on areas outside those regions that have ability to increase additional and raise additional taxes, because you know the hurt will be felt statewide if some of these rural areas can't continue to develop some revenue generating businesses in those areas. So I stress that one is shouldn't be. I don't take it to the bottom of the page that it's not important, but I'd like to see it up near the top for consideration.
Thank you very much, Christine. There was no thought process in terms of how these. I should have advertised, I guess. Well, safety is on the front, but beyond that, there was not a lot of thought process there. I do think with each of these things that they're set upon. With regionalism, I think the government has talked a lot about the importance of building on the infrastructure and so forth that's available in a particular region. We talk a lot about regionalism. At the same time, you are about the state of Virginia. And it's not just about the wealthy region, but it's about the rural as well. So we have a conflict. What I would see here would be a white paper kind of thing where we look at the conflict and we make some recommendations in terms of what kind of choices we would have for each of these. So the regionalism is one of those elements that I think we do have some trade-offs that have to occur, and it has to be a lot of discussion in that area.
Mr. McCarthy.
Ralph, what does preservation mean on that list?
Preservation is, it's very broad. You talk about maintenance, you talk about your bridges, you're talking about largely along that line. It's very broad. You can define it however you would like, but it's largely about maintenance and bridges and roads and the whole system of your transit system.
Okay. That's sort of what I thought, but I wanted to make sure. On the environmental arena, of course, the governor has now appointed his climate change commission.
Yes.
I'm not sure their schedule. At one point, I heard they're going to try to finish up by the end of this year. Transportation is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in Virginia. I don't know what they're going to conclude ought to be done about that to adapt or change or reduce or whatever they're going to do eventually, but clearly that's going to have some kind of effect on what transportation looks like in 2035. So I guess I'm just trying to encourage you as strongly as possible to weigh in with that commission and stay attuned to it.
One other choice that's not on here that should be, and it's energy. Essentially, transportation is the largest energy source in the Commonwealth. It uses 43% of all energy is transportation. And that needs to be here, and what kinds of things do we need to do? The governor has an energy plan. Some of what I need to do and we need to do is look at what's in the energy plan, what are those goals that they've set, and a lot of it's about more fuel efficient vehicles. It's about using more transit and more rail and those kinds of things. But it's a critical part of the process and needs to be fully integrated into what we're doing. Other key components, I'm on slide 10 now. There's the finance section. We need to not only look at state, but federal and local, and with the partnerships. We need to look at House Bill 32 and 2, and how does that fit into this whole process? When we did V-Trans 2025, there was no 32 or 2. I like to think that V-Trans had something to do about it. But we need to figure out how does that fit into our overall revenue outlook. We need the latest revenue forecasts. Then investment adequacy. We did a lot of work on that last time. We talked about the crossover. We talked about maintenance. How it was $400 million, it's down to $200 million. Sooner or later, we have more and more issues that were moving basic construction money into maintenance. We need to look at that. What are the minimal needs? That's one of the things we did last time. What are the minimal needs to make the transportation fund whole? And I think we will look at that again as well. In terms of oversight, my plans would be to come before you very often, probably at workshops to give you updates in terms of where we are. Again, this is your plan, and a lot of feedback from you on that. I would see you actively involved in the summit that I've mentioned in terms of planning and being engaged in that process. I think the key area of policy is really around these trends and choices. I would like to see you heavily engaged in that process and make sure that what you see as trends and what potential choices, you engaged in that. We will have several advisory committees. One is the advisory committee of basically multiple agency heads who are basically looking more at the actual plans that are out there, make sure there's consistency and there's coordination across plans. We had a technical committee last time. These are staff people from various multiple agencies. They help see communication between the agencies, so all agency staff folks know what's going on. This is really often a public kind of document, so we need to get stakeholders involved in the process as well.
Mr. Chairman, Ralph, did you include in that, maybe it's coming further down, legislator involvement?
I did not include the legislative or legislator involvement. Legislators have not historically been that involved. The way we get them involved is we have gone around the state to present the long-term forecast. We can, and the Department also has to look at them. We haven't necessarily gotten involved in up front.
It would seem that the committees and transportation especially, it might be really helpful to, at some phase, draw them into the giving them a chance to have an input while they learn all the things that are also being recommended by all the other constituencies. It would be, if it's possible, it would be a very positive thing.
For VTrans 2025, I did go before several legislative bodies, but it was really at the end of the process rather, and but perhaps something we can think about is up front of the process.
I would acknowledge they now have a joint commission on transportation accountability, which is both House and Senate membership, and that might be a good body. We're starting to use that to brief them on our major PPTA projects. It's a good point of contact, and you don't have that division necessarily between House and Senate. So I think that's an excellent suggestion we should easily incorporate into our process.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I do want to acknowledge and compliment the Deputy Secretary on particularly the piece on page 9 of your overheads of the slide on page 9. If you look at that in the perspective I've looked at it, departure from the traditional thought process around developing long-range plans. By going to topic matter, and as I viewed that list and think about it, I think the real question on the table is it gives us as staff working on these kinds of activities a way to parse and put together manageable topics, and it's an easy way for people to articulate what the end state number of chapters in this book ought to look like. One of the lessons we've learned, at least in the states I've worked on, people get lost in the journey. But if you can articulate the topics, it gives you the freedom to think about what you would want to know about in 2035. This week, as I participated at the Transportation Research Board proceedings, which obviously is a worldwide gathering. This has been a pretty specific set of topics that has been going on, and there's much to be learned from that. When you bring 10,000 people together from across the world, all of a sudden you can define a set of chapters. We can then produce papers very quickly because there's a large body of both international and national information from which to draw as we put a Virginia twist on where we think we want to be in 2035. So I do need to compliment and acknowledge the work the Deputy Secretary has done in putting this framework together, because I think it's a major step forward in the way to think about this.
Thank you. Other questions or comments?
As sort of the godmother of the first plan, I am very, very encouraged about the continuation and the expansion. And I'm just, good luck. I'm very glad that you added the energy onto page 9, because that's something I feel very strongly about, not only to minimize our environmental footprint, but also to recognize some of the pricing impacts that of gasoline at $6 and $8 a gallon. Our issues may be substantially different, but that is sort of, you know, there's plan A and plan B, but I think we have to consider at least some of that as a possibility. But I'm just, again, heartened by this, and I think it's a very reasonable approach. And
Mr. Dickens.
I would like to compliment the godmother of this 2025 and all those folks who were involved with this thing. It's a great product and a good roadmap. I'd like to also agree that my friend Mr. Davis's suggestion of bringing legislators in is an excellent idea. If they're involved with the process, they're learning, and they're also understanding what is decisions that are being made and how they're being made. I agree with that. And Mr. Keene's comment about regionalism, I can't agree more that a regional look at the transportation network is critical. If you look at it in any other way, you're going to end up with an inefficient and expensive product. So I would encourage that to be very high up on the list. I agree 100%.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Davis. And what I would hope that as we stage the work plan, because this is at the end of the day the CTB's long-range plan, that we can space out some of the work products for deliberation. There were some technical reports, there were some policy issues, and my hope would be that, assuming those deliverables get reasonably as projected, we get through the subdivision street regulations, which are going to take a lot of time, but by the time we're done with that we can devote at every session some very significant effort on either the policy issues or the technical reports, and that way we kind of do it a chapter at a time. You're not asked to swallow a single 3,000 page report at the last minute, which I think all of us would appreciate. Okay, thank you. The next item on the agenda is the I-95, 395 transit and TDM study, and Mr. Corey Hill presents.
Cookie glass, but that's all right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Again, I'm Corey Hill here to talk to you today about a study that is complementary to the I-95 395 Top Lanes project. This particular study is called the 95-395 Transit and Transportation Demand Management Study. Quick study background for you. The I-95-395 Hot Lanes project and the I-495 Hot Lanes project are both consistent in that they provide improved opportunities for transit. The I-95-395 Hot Lanes project scope currently, as it is conceived, includes significant benefits for transit. The scope includes 3,000 new park and ride spaces, 33 new entry and exit ramps, an inline bus rapid transit station, and a 28-mile extension of the HOV lanes. That's already included in their scope. When the private partners last year discussed this project and the scope and these benefits for transit, they also put together a proposal for extending, improving transit above and beyond that, and they made a commitment of about $195 million. That proposal was provided to the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments as part of the input into their constrained long-range plan, and at the same time, we, the Department of Rail and Public Transportation, were asked to work with a technical advisory committee consisting of federal, state, regional, local jurisdictional staff, transit operators, so on and so forth, to do a more complex and detailed analysis and then come back the following year, this time, with an update to the proposal that was made for transit last year. So that's where we are. And again, just one point of emphasis, the improvements that we're talking about are above and beyond the scope items that you see on the second bullet. Funding for improvements, though, would also be coming from the commitment, in addition to the commitment from the private sector, we would expect revenues to come from Farebox, from the Farebox as the operators operate new service and collect money for that service, and then federal discretionary funds. The important point that I want to emphasize to you all, though, is that the revenue, the $195 million commitment, from the private sector is not a done deal yet. That dedicated revenue is subject to final negotiation by VDOT and Floor Transurban, and ultimately comes back to you for allocation. So at a point in the future, if a deal is successfully negotiated, if those revenues are secured, then we will come back to you about how those funds are allocated. But this study is a proposal as to how that might happen. Touching on the study corridor, it's a 56-mile study corridor. To the south, we've got Massaponics. To the north, the District of Columbia. The study also, though, felt that it was important because we're looking at transit, we're looking at travel markets. So we know that there's a significant portion of the traveling public that's coming up the 95 corridor and taking the Beltway to places like Tyson's Corner and Merrifield. So we've looked at some additional markets beyond just up and down the line, so to speak. In terms of goals for the study had two major goals. Number one, preserve transit and HOV ridership while implementing hot lanes. There was some concern from the community that hot lanes would impact transit, and people wanted to make sure that that didn't happen. And secondly, a goal of utilizing the new hot lanes features to attract new transit and HOV riders. How do we use this as a benefit and further grow the transit market? An important point to keep in mind is that this is a very mature corridor. There are a number of existing transit and transportation demand management services in the corridor today. You've got bus service, and you can see when I say northern and southern portion on these bullets, the northern portion would be the existing HOV lane facility that's out there today that goes from Dumfries north to the district. South would be the number of buses that are coming up from the Massaponics area up through the corridor. Rail service, you've got Metro Rail service in the corridor today. You've got Virginia Railway Express on their Fredericksburg line operates in the corridor today. There's some Amtrak service. Also of significance, you've got 500 van pools, which is a very big number in terms of the size of that fleet, 21 park and ride lots, and then 19 slugging locations as well. So there's a huge effort and a huge alternative transportation market out there today. Great question. For slugging is basically is carpooling that occurs at the park and ride lots. It's actually, it's not a government program. It was something created by the citizens. It's rather innovative. And they actually even have kind of their own rules and procedures. And basically people go to a park and ride lot and look for additional people to come by, pick them up so that they can take advantage of the HOV lanes rather than having to drive by themselves in the general purpose lanes. So it's organized carpooling is a simple term.
And Mr. Hill and members of the CTB, the chair is a former slugger, so when you look at it, you can see what a slugger looks like.
That's right. And it's a very interesting phenomenon. It's one that is very well recognized for Northern Virginia. And it's people using the market to find creative ways to get to work, and they take advantage of the park and ride lots and work with each other to take advantage of the HOV lanes. It's quite successful. And you'll see in just a minute, it's a community that's very concerned about this project, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in just a minute. As we talk about doing this kind of study, the first thing that we start with is we take a look at what is the existing service out there, which I just described, and then on top of it, for the region's long-range plan, what are they saying that they're already going to do? And we take that existing network and what people are saying they're already going to do in their long-range plan, and we call that the baseline. And then from there, we look at alternatives above and beyond that to determine how effective they'll be compared to the baseline. Now, this was a comprehensive effort because you've got a 56-mile corridor, multiple jurisdictions, multiple operators, multiple modes, many things going on. And so collectively, when we worked with the technical advisory committee, we came up with 60 different strategies to analyze as part of this study. And because it was such a vast universe of strategies, we decided that the logical way to go forward would be to group them into three different tiers and then test those three tiers. And the way we did that was by grouping them financially. Now, because the VDOT Floor Transurban contract is not a done deal, we had to make some basic assumptions on different levels of investment. At the same time, we recognized, though, that people would want to see what is the ultimate vision of the corridor and how do some of those ultimate improvements perform as well. So we've got a low tier that's targeted about approximately $250 million of investment, a medium tier at about $500 million, and then a high tier, which is financially unconstrained, just so that we can see the max of what we can do. The low alternative, in simple terms, would increase existing bus service and bus service that's planned in the long-range plan by 100%. It would expand VRE capacity and provide just a number of improvements that you see listed here below, in addition, again, to what's already planned. The medium alternative would increase bus service by 145%, would include the concept of bus rapid transit, and again, a substantial increase in VRE service. And then the high alternative, the unconstrained, you have again 145% increase in bus service, but 130% increase in VRE service, as well as a Metrorail extension to Potomac Mills bus testing. So basically, if you took those three alternatives, the low, the medium, and the high, and you compared them to what's going on out there in the existing environment today and what's planned in the future, you see that we are making those kind of increases, and this is kind of just sort of an imaginary line just south of Springfield. How many buses are operating over that line an hour, how many VRE trains, how many Metro trains. It just sort of gives you some perspective about the increase in the tiers. When you take 60 different strategies like that, you need several different ways to analyze them. What we did was we used a travel forecasting demand model that is a common tool for the Northern Virginia market. It's based on the Transportation Planning Board's model. We also used market research, and we also used the experience of the Technical Advisory Committee and input from the public and a number of policy boards, such as the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority, the Northern Virginia Transportation Commission, the Potomac and Rappahannock Transportation Commission, and our friends down to the south, FAMPO, the Fredericksburg Area MPO. I'm going to focus on this slide about the travel forecasting. It's just one tool in the toolbox, but here's what the results were from that effort. We realized that the CLRP that was in the baseline alternative, it's part of it, has significant service additions and is already a very strong performer. We were surprised at just how much transit service the region is already contemplating in the core. And it was an important finding to make sure that all the locals knew just how much transit they had signed up for in their long-range plan. It was important to discuss that with them and make sure that that was a true and valid assumption. Secondly, the most difference between the tested alternatives was really in the competition among transit modes. One of the things that we were very sensitive to was if you're making investments and you're putting new services out there in a quarter that's already robust, how many people are we taking out of single-occupant vehicles versus how many people are we taking out of a bus and putting onto a train? And trying to figure out where are people shifting to as you introduce new strategies into the environment. Our goal, obviously, to be getting single-occupant vehicle motorists out of their cars and into transit, and not so much to take them out of van pools and put them in a bus, or take them out of a bus and put them in a train. The hot lanes generally did not adversely impact transit or carpool mode share versus today, which is, again, a very key finding. Many people were very nervous that people were going to bail out of transit and use the hot lanes, and we're finding that generally speaking, that was not the case. Transit and carpooling enjoy an incredibly huge share of the market. Northbound in the morning, what you will find is that roughly 65% of the folks that are traveling northbound in the morning trying to get into the District of Columbia, 65% are in alternative transportation. They're in a carpool, they're in a van pool, they're on a bus, they're on a train. That is an enormous percentage market share for a quarter like this. So an incredibly important piece of information. They are the ones that, you know, all that alternative transportation is what allows the roadway to work as well as it does today. And even today, it's not working that great, many would agree. The transit TDM alternatives do maintain that mode share, again, even with significant increases of travel in the quarter. So they're holding their own as we test those alternatives. And many of the new routes that we found performed very well. So while there's a lot of transit service in the quarter today, we found a lot of good opportunities for new service that would work well if we implemented it. Moving on to the market research, this is kind of interesting because typically what you do is you have a number of rounds of public meetings, and that is your opportunity for public input. We felt that it's difficult for people to get to those public meetings, the elementary school on a rainy Thursday night, so we wanted to find more opportunities for the public to engage in this process. So we had an online survey that we invited people to participate in that gave us statistically reliable results and allowed us to analyze many different markets in many different ways. And this is just a couple of the highlights, but there's a lot more information that we have in our files. But basically, awareness of hot lanes is very high. Nearly all sluggers are aware of the hot lanes. Again, they're that community that I mentioned before that is really sensitive as to what the impacts, what the benefits of this project are going to be all about. Interestingly enough, the SOV users were the least aware of the hot lanes project, but still a high level of awareness at 75%. The sluggers were especially likely to believe that hot lanes were going to discourage drivers from picking up sluggers. What they thought was, instead of a driver coming into a park and ride lot, picking up a couple of passengers and then traveling on the HOV lanes, now that as a driver, I can get into the HOV lanes and pay money and drive by myself, I don't need to bother with picking people up anymore. And that's what their real fear was. However, most transit and HOV commuters said that they will not change their commute in any way when the hot lanes are open and functional. And what's interesting is, again, you've got an incredibly high number of sluggers and carpoolers that are saying, I'm not going to abandon what I do today when you put this new option out on the street. I'm going to stay in transit. I'm going to stay in my carpool. I'm going to stay in my bus, you know, whatever it is I do today. And a lot of that we're sensing is so much in Northern Virginia where the congestion is so high, you're building your life a lot around how you get to work. It is such a challenge up there that people are, you know, the van works for me. It allows me to keep the schedule I need for my family. I'm not going to go and change that now. Now, as you see, though, for the SOVs, only 53%. So you are going to see a number of single-occupant vehicle motorists that are traveling in the general-purpose lanes taking advantage of the hot lanes. The likelihood of using the hot lanes is highest among commuters from the south, Spotsylvania, Stafford, and Prince William County. One interesting finding that we didn't expect was that 34% of the SOVers say there's no park and ride lot located along their commute to catch express bus, or if there is a lot, it's usually full. But 24% of them couldn't answer this question. They didn't know if a park and ride lot was near them or not. And when we asked them if there was one that you were aware of and it was near you, would you use it? And 11% said yes. So right off the bat, we know that we've got a communications issue in which we need to let people, you know, have greater awareness of where park and ride lots are and what the services that are available at those park and ride lots are. And just by doing that, we can probably increase usage of transit right there without a major investment. From the three major tiers of alternatives, the low, the medium, and the high, we then said, okay, time to boil this thing down and get to a bottom line on it. And when we did that, we kind of created a refined alternative that was made up of the best performing strategies. So we took those 60 strategies, picked the best ones out of the low and the medium and the high, and developed a refined alternative that was basically about a $650 million package of investments, $230 million of capital, and enough money to operate the services for 20 years. From there, we then took our final step in the process, which was, again, to come back and improve upon the input that was provided in the constrained long-range plan last year, which meant that we needed to take our refined alternative and financially constrain it. The way we did that was we prioritized and phased the proposed improvements based on productivity, ease of implementation, and long-term regional effects. We also did our best to look at available funding sources, and then also needed to recognize that, you know, we wanted to respect what was already currently planned and programmed and not duplicate or use those valuable revenues from the Hot Lanes project to do something that someone else was already planning to do and fund. So from that, the refined alternative finally boiled down to the fiscally constrained alternative. And from there, you've got about a $298 million package. It includes $195 million hot lanes lump sum payment, about $40 million of federal discretionary funding, and $63 million in revenues recovered from the fare box. The fare box recovery figure, unlike the proposal from last year, is derived from actual services proposed. So we sharpened the pencil to make sure that fare box recovery figure was as accurate as possible. Also, a big difference from last year was the proposal was to operate a lot of bus service, which generated a lot of fare box revenue. Here, the technical advisory committee felt very strongly that there were a number of important facility improvements, like bus rapid transit stations, for example, and additional park and ride spaces that were important to invest the money in park and ride lots and the bus rapid transit stations are capital facilities that are not generating revenue. So that revenue figure for the fare box recovery is lower in this proposal compared to last year's for that reason. In terms of, okay, so what do I get for the refined, fiscally constrained alternative? The bottom line for that $298 million package is you get about $137 million for the capital improvements and enough money to operate the services for 20 years at a cost of about $161 million. Again, that package breaks down into a number of service modifications, so taking existing bus services and increasing their frequency, for example, extending the hours of bus service or the days that bus service is provided, and increasing the length of VRE trains. So we don't have to purchase a new slot for a VRE train. We're really just lengthening the train, and as an example, from 6 cars to 8 cars so we can carry more passengers. And it's a great bang for the buck idea. New services, there's all kinds of new bus routes that are important, that provide great new service. We did take the BRAC into consideration as we were talking about some of this and the changes that would happen there and how do we better serve the base. And just a number of routes all up and down the corridor. Facility improvements, we've got improvements to two existing Metrorail centers and a new transit center down at Massaponics is proposed. 5 inline BRT stations, platform extensions for VRE, and a number of other items. And then transportation and demand management program elements as well that we thought would be important for the carpoolers and the van poolers. One thing I will say is that while we did not go at this with the strategy of how do we get 10% of the investment in Fredericksburg, 10% in Stafford, 10% here, 10% there, we really were going straight for what are the best performing bang for the buck strategies, period. What's been a nice result, though, is you look at all of these improvements, there's great equity up and down the corridor. Every jurisdiction is getting improvements. Every jurisdiction is getting service enhancements that are going to benefit the citizens in that jurisdiction. Finally, our next steps, again, is to revise that CLRP submission. That's happening as we speak. That proposal has been put forward. It is a proposal. Again, we'll be coming back to you for actual allocation of dollars based on specific strategies. We'll issue a final report likely at the end of the month or early February. And then the next step is to continue to work with VDOT, who served on the technical advisory committee with us, to advance elements of the recommendation that potentially impact roadway design, such as those bus rapid transit stations. We want to work closely with the private sector and VDOT to make sure that the design of those facilities is done in a successful way so that VDOT doesn't go forward and then we come back a year later and say, hey, wait a second, you got to change something. So we're working together on that, and that's really one of our key next steps. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Hill?
To what extent has the district been engaged in this? I don't recall whether you said they were on your advisory panel. Because I know the 14th Street Bridge is certainly an important link, final link into the district, and it doesn't belong to us.
That's true. It is a key issue, and we have been working with the District of Columbia and talking to them about all of the issues that you've described in various forms. VDOT talking with the district about 14th Street Bridge, DRPT and WMATA talking with the district about the improvements that would go down there and how do we do that. We have more work to do there. And that's part of the effort is now that we know what strategies work, we really need to kind of bring together some very specific service planning ideas, talking about, you know, perhaps improving the traffic lights and how do we make it flow once we get into the district. And that's a key effort that's coming up as well.
Okay, I have one other question. It's a sort of a in-the-weeds question, but when you were talking about the 65% that go up and down the corridor that are not in SOVs, do you know if that what the figure would be for those who peel off on 495, what their occupancy ratio might be?
I don't have that figure. The 65% figure actually comes from a VDOT traffic count study that was looking at basically, again, an imaginary screen line just south of the district on, you know, covering 395 and Route 1 and the like. There has not been a traffic count study that's done exactly that. The percentage down, as you get further south, that percentage goes down. But I can't tell you this. I don't have the data to tell you by how much.
Yeah, I was just interested as we were looking at congestion management for some of the Tysons area and the impact. I was wondering if we had some data on.
Right. We do know, though, that and it was important to us to look at Tysons. that there are some existing bus routes in the CLRP that are already planned, and part of the package here for the financially constrained package is additional bus routes to serve Tysons, because it is an important traffic market.
Mr. Coolmay.
Corey, one of the assumptions that people often make is that new highway capacity generates its own traffic. Is one of the assumptions of this study that increased capacity for transit, particularly bus rapid transit, will create additional traffic or additional ridership? Just by it being there?
Right. What you have today is you have a pretty robust express bus market that's operating today. Part of the challenge is, though, always travel times, reliability, and things of that nature. And I think one of the things that we heard from the public, I heard specifically myself from our public meetings, was people are looking for almost the highest quality service they can possibly get. And I think part of bus rapid transit with the inline stations gives you that faster travel time, that greater convenience, that higher quality service that people are really after. I think a key aspect, though, of working with VDOT and Fortran's Urban is making sure, obviously, that the travel speeds that the buses enjoy today will be maintained and protected so that we can, again, have that scheduled reliability and those travel time advantages over the general purpose lines.
Mr. Chairman, the best explanation of this whole project that I've ever heard is we're going to improve transit and HOV's capacity in this corridor and sell the excess to individual drivers and vehicles. And to me, those are the primary, these are the primary benefits of the whole Hot Lanes proposal. I'll ask you this about sluggers, because it seems to be counterintuitive what they think. If now people slug because they can save time, why wouldn't they also slug more if they can also save money?
Well, I think you're right. I think, again, people are saying that they are going to save too much people. We're not going to see people deviate from slugging. There's two reasons why.
Mr. Hill.
Yes, sir.
Could you describe for the CTB what a slugger
is?
Yes.
We did. Yeah. While you were out of the room.
We decided to name it dynamic carpooling.
Okay. They caught me much quicker on that.
Okay.
I didn't get too far before I was stopped on that, although we'll throw out an additional term very quickly while we're talking about it. The people that go by and pick up the people that are standing at the park and ride lots, we refer to them affectionately as body snatchers. So if you hear that term, and a less popular term, I think, is scrapers and sluggers. So the sluggers are the people at the park and ride lots that ride. The scrapers are the ones that pick them up.
The way it really works is the driver drives up to the line, says, 14th and K.
Right.
Each person in line, the first guy gets to make a decision. That may be close to where he's going, or he may not want to go, so he passes. The first three who accept that as a destination climb the car and they're off.
And they'll actually line up in specific lines based on the locations that they're at.
Same way in
very
town.
Very organized approach to it.
Yeah. In town, you'll stand at a certain corner knowing that's where people pick up to go back. So Pentagon, there are destinations.
It's real time.
An observation I'd like to make on your market research page is I know Arlington spends over $2 million a year simply publicizing its transit services, where buses go. If you're ignorant in Arlington about transit, it's because you can't read here and you don't go anywhere. But that would be an important component about availability and use is just people understanding and having information about.
And that's part of those transportation demand management programs is increasing the marketing outreach and increasing the awareness. Again, that finding that 24% of people didn't know if they had a park and ride lot available to them, and if they did, 11% of them would use it.
I have one last.
That's a great low-cost bang for the buck strategy to work on.
I have one last question. This project overlaps the two districts, but it also overlaps two transit districts and planning districts and other kinds of things. I mean, I didn't see any reference to the sort of built-in governance issues here. Is this vision you expecting to be and planning expect to be carried down to each one of those units, or have you made any recommendations about perhaps combining or forming some new unit that would actually make this work a lot better?
Right. Certainly, we're talking about program management here for a corridor, and we've got the Technical Advisory Committee, which has helped us come up with the recommendation at this point. And when we come back to you with specific programming decisions, right now in terms of governance, it's envisioned that DRPT would be the one coming back to you all to make the, with a recommendation for you all to make the decision. But clearly what we're going to tell you is based on input we received from the Technical Advisory Committee. It's, that work is not done. You know, that body, I think, will continue to work with us as we move things forward. We also have to work through two CLRPs. We have the Transportation Planning Board CLRP in Washington, and then we have the one in Fredericksburg. The one in Fredericksburg, the timing was a little bit further behind, so we had to get to the Washington one first, but we will be coming to the Fredericksburg one as well to make sure that these recommendations and inputs are part of that planning process and are incorporated in the necessary documents.
Mr. Tucker wanted to comment.
And I think the question that you raised, Mr. Coulomb, is excellent. One of the things that I think as we started to look at Northern Virginia, and if you look at the projects from the Beltway project to this project to Dulles Rail, and going back even to the Deputy Secretary's presentation on regionalism, we really have to start looking at these transit projects and even some of the way transit is operated from a more regional perspective. I mean, when I looked at this project, one of the things I said to Mr. Hill is he was becoming the lead with the different communities with working with the Technical Advisory Committee. That at the end of the day, we should be focused on mobility in the corridor and not necessarily what are my parochial needs, desires, and wants with money that may be available. And I think as we continue to refine the work that he's doing here, along with the work that we're doing toward development of a statewide plan and really start focusing in on corridors, that's where we're going to get to those sets of questions and difficult choices that are going to have to have people act differently. Bus rapid transit is something that we've talked a lot about internally as an agency, and one reason we talk about bus rapid transit because it's a lot easier to do from a financial perspective and an operating point of view than for us to say we're going to implement a metro rail extension or implement light rail. But within that framework, you got to have a pretty dynamic system-oriented plan in place to make it work. And so this is going to be part of the curve and the learning curve that we're going to have to make as a state towards looking at different modes and figuring out how to incorporate it and not necessarily be from a parochial approach. It's going to have to be more on a regional basis.
Okay. If there's no other questions or comments, thank you, Mr. Hill. That's a very challenging, but a real cutting-edge project like the Beltway hot lanes as well. The next item on the agenda is the Rail Industrial Access Project, Reyes Holdings, item 6. Welcome, Mr. Page. Yet another good investment, not only in transportation, but in employment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Mr. Hill was talking about scrapers and sluggers. I'm going to talk about McDonald's French fries and hamburgers. So it's amazing DRPT is widening its breadth of what we're doing here in Virginia. What I'm doing today is I'm briefing you, the 30-day pre-briefing on a rail industrial access project. This is an exciting project for us. It's been several months with Reyes Holdings, which is doing business in Virginia as Lone Oak, up in the Prince William County area. I'll be going in more detail in a second, but the $450,000 action item with the $150,000 local match requirement will be coming to the board at the February 20th meeting. Reyes Holdings is doing business in Virginia as a Martin Brower Corporation. For those of you who are familiar with the Gainesville area up in that along Prince William County, this is a site that will be located off of Randolph Ridge Lane out in between Wellington and Gainesville. It's located on Norfolk Southern's Manassas line, and it does provide good local service on a daily basis. This project, again, is a Martin Brower development under Reyes Holdings. They are the company that supplies McDonald's hamburgers, French fries franchises. 600 of those franchises will be served out of this facility. If you ever want to see what one of these looks like inside, Modern Marvels did a special on cable TV, obviously, on how food service is being mechanized for the quality and consistency of those services, and Martin Brower is a big part of that. They're currently located in Prince William County today. The challenge, Mr. Chairman and members of the board, was that they were now going to have to ramp up to higher standards to supply a more consistent and quality product. Martin Brower then worked with the county and the Department of Rail and Public Transportation to put forth a strategy with the Economic Development Partnership that would seek to locate them again in the county. They're basically moving down the tracks, and to use a McDonald's term, they're going to supersize their facility. They're going to set out a new rail facility that will accommodate up to 12 rail cars at a time, and they will have a ramping of beginning around 500 cars and then moving up from there on a basis over the next 15 years. This $22 million project is going to retain 225 employees and also provide 65 additional jobs in the new mechanized plant that they're putting together. We will again come back to you in February, and Prince William County did approve the local resolution in October 2nd of 2007, and the Economic Development Partnership has also come forth in support of this project in coordination with that. Mr. Chairman, if there are any questions, I'll put this back to you, and I'll be happy to come back to the board in February for action.
Any questions for Ms. Page?
I'm just curious. I never would have expected McDonald's to use so much rail. What do they get?
That's a very good question. Potatoes come from the Midwest. Beef comes in refrigerated cars now in large volumes. And also Martin Brower is supplying into the Latin American continent now. So under NAFTA and the good trade quarters that Norfolk Southern has been able to put forth in working with what they refer to as our crescent quarter, we're hoping to see even greater opportunities than just domestic traffic within the United States, but also some traffic that could go south of the border.
Got it. That's very interesting. And what's their service area? I mean, is it a tri-state? Is it, do they go as far as Maryland, or what?
Currently today it's along the Mid-Atlantic regional states.
The center will service.
Yes, ma'am. Hmm. Yes, ma'am. 600 restaurants is what they will be serving out of this one facility.
So that's three counties. Mr. Page, is it fair to say that this investment will occur in roughly the same location where the I-81 rail improvements are occurring?
Yes, sir, and that's the reason why you see that the county actually passed a resolution back in October. DRPT is making an assertive effort that we come to the CTB with projects that don't interfere with other projects. And what we did was we actually went back to Norfolk Southern, and Martin Brower worked very collectively with them, and in a cooperative fashion, we actually moved the second track project just a little bit so that we could get that switch in and accommodate without conflicts to potential expansion of BRE service or the I-81 Phase 1 project that's being funded through the General Assembly's actions.
But theoretically, absent those rail improvements, some of these potatoes might be coming on a truck and over 64 and up 81 and up 66. So this, you know, this is the kind of investment. Granted, it's a couple $100,000, but it does make a difference, and it meshes with some of our larger investment goals. Thank you so much.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next item is the DRP Director's Report, Mr. Tucker. And we'll take a break after the work session.
Mr. Chair, I promise to be quick. A couple of housekeeping items. I know from the CTB meeting that we had back in Roanoke a couple of months ago, there were questions relative to the 81 freight study. I know Mr. McCarthy had raised some questions, and Mr. Davis. We are, in fact, working on answers to that questions. We've submitted the questions to the consultants, and we're working through those answers, and we look forward to coming back to you next month, and we'll try to catch you before the meeting to discuss the findings based upon the questions that we received. I also wanted to update on a couple of other items. One item I want to update, if you recall from the 2007 budget language, there was a requirement that DRPT execute an operating agreement with CSX prior to allocation of additional funds to CSX for rail improvements. We have executed that agreement with them. That agreement sort of sets the stage for the future direction of passenger rail in the Commonwealth. There's two big pieces of information in there. One, we've set an internal policy goal of an on-time performance of 95% for passenger rail for the state of Virginia. If you're aware that Amtrak and CSX were doing a study for 80% on-time performance over the entire Amtrak range of operations, but what we've said in Virginia that the standard has to be a lot higher if we truly want to see people get out of their car and get into the train. The other issue is that we've gotten CSX to agree with us on development of basis of design requirements and agreement on means and methods for construction activities. This goes back to the heart and soul of some of the heat restriction issues that have occurred historically. It really deals with the fact that we know that we're going to be operating a railroad that's going to have both freight and passenger rail needs. And it cuts both ways when you talk that, to have the discussion about reaching agreement on basis of design requirements, because at the end of the day, it ultimately means in some instances you're going to pay more in order to make sure that you can have the passenger rail operate with the reliability and speeds that you're looking for. But that is well underway with CSX, and we're in the process now of looking at additional agreements that help move the ball forward for passenger rail. One other item I wanted to update everyone on is the asset management system development. One of the interesting discussions in Virginia is that we're a maintenance first state. That's actually only been implemented, Mr. Chair, on VDOT's side of the house. If you look at the Department of Rail and Public Transportation, we really have not had a program that was essentially a maintenance first. Throughout all of the years, when we had the years of 22% match availability, we took new projects in at the same time. What the asset management system is going to allow us to do is, one, get a good understanding of the condition of key assets throughout the state. And it's also going to help us in terms of looking at various allocation scenarios, depending on whether we got a lot of money or we got less money than we thought we had. And it's going to really put you in a position as a board to have better information about the choices that we make in allocating funds. As you all are aware, we received a $60 million additional funding from HB 3202 through the bond program, and that is comes from a different pot that has some restricted uses that go against with the standard funds that we use that cover a wide array of capital needs. So we're going to have to look at how we fund items that are eligible. And then when we look at that, we're going to also be probably having some capability in some instances to fund new projects. But the key question is going to be, what are the projects that provide the highest rate of return for the Commonwealth of Virginia? So July 1, we're going to be in a position to be able to present a baseline of information to you, and I think it's going to fundamentally change the way that we look at transit in Virginia and help us be able to predict out over a short range, 6-year, and a long range vision, 20 years, of what our asset needs are going to be on the transit side. I also wanted to update the board on the meetings that we've had with the Federal Railroad Administration. I know folks have heard a lot of discussion about funding being created to support Amtrak. The Federal Railroad Administration actually would be the entity in charge of administering those funds. There are two programs that they have up and running. One is a mainline relocation fund that essentially provides money to communities and or states or public entities to offset costs towards moving rail traffic from one line to another line. It's not a lot of money, but it's $20 million that's going to be available to that. Of the $20 million, $5 million has already been earmarked, so you can look for $15 million that would be available on a nationwide basis. There's also a state's grant program that was created. That program is a 50-50 match between the Federal Railroad Administration and states, and that fund would provide about $30 million on an annual basis to support projects for enhanced passenger rail. We've had a lot of discussions with the folks at FRA, and we're trying to be prepared at the point that they actually release, accept applications to support projects and initiatives that may be important to Virginia. The last thing is just I want to update on a couple of studies really quickly. We're going to be moving forward with the regional transit study for the Hampton Roads region. We've talked to all of the parties in the region, from the MPO to the Transit Authority, and we're all on the same page in terms of moving forward with that. The Richmond area study is already underway, but we also have worked with Greater Richmond Transit Company. They have plans for bus rapid transit, so we're going to collaborate with them on a bus rapid transit project that we hope to move forward rather quickly. If you take a look out on Broad Street, there have been bus-only lanes striped. One of the things, they're tight, and we're really starting to take a good look within our own backyard of how can we make transit much more relevant in the region. That's my home transit system. It's a system that I think has some opportunities, and we're looking forward to work with them. And interestingly enough, we've been receiving a lot of requests from rural communities for us to come in and work with them on regional transit studies. Martinsville and a couple other areas have sent us letters that we responded back to saying that we would support them in terms of needing to complete regional studies to either determine the feasibility or look at a long-range approach to provide public transit. That completes my comments, Mr. Chair.
Questions, Mr. Tucker? Mr. Davis?
Any possibility of that cross the top of Northern Virginia for rail service? Has that been included in any of the discussions?
And, well, I think if you look at the legislation that's out there, it's a requirement for us to look at a rail within Virginia, particularly the 95 corridor. But we have been looking at throughout the state of Virginia in all of our rail planning activities for passenger rail, looking at what is short range and what is long range for the state of Virginia.
So speaking of Winchester to Manassas.
We're looking at that.
Any other questions?
Congratulations on the CSX agreement.
Thank you, Mr. Tucker. The final presentation is by the ever-patient Mike Estes, who has a collection of local assistance programs that are among the most difficult to administer in the Commonwealth. And thank you for being with us today and sharing your views on recreational access fund policies.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Difficult, but they are fun. So we're going to make this fun. Six slides or less on recreational access. You'll be getting a policy hopefully next month for your approval, and that's what we're going to talk about is kind of what that is going to be next month. So we're down to five to go. But I would start with a general overview of kind of the program itself. Just a simple reminder. It is, of course, set in code. We're granted about $1.5 million each year through the Appropriation Act. Provides access to public recreational areas or historical sites, roads and bikeways, an important factor of the program. And we do a lot of extensive coordination with both the Department of Conservation and Recreation as well as the Department of Historic Resources. Again, limits are set by law. We can fund up to $400,000 for state sites. We can fund $250,000 unmatched with an additional $100,000 match for locality or authority sites. And bikeways are funded actually separately. We can fund up to $75,000 maximum for a state site and $60,000 unmatched with additional $15,000 match for locality or authority sites. One of the big emphases is, it's also in the CPB policy, is the fact that land acquisition and utility relocations, we typically leave those to the authority, the state agency developing the site, or the locality. Recent changes, and this has been, you'll see here in a minute, most of them came out of a legislative session a few years back. Really, they were to kind of bring us back into line with practice that we had been utilizing already within our guidance, and really I think was somewhat inferred already in the CTB policy, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But through some discussions we were having on a potential project, and I'll show you an example, the Attorney General's office brought up a concern of whether we could actually grant two access roads into one facility. I'll give you a good example here in a minute. So we brought that to the attention of DCR a couple years ago. They picked up a legislative proposal, moved that forward to the General Assembly, and have corrected that concern in the code. For the policy next month, again, we'll clarify some of that as well. During that correction, during 2005, Department of Historic Resources asked for a little more participation level with the program, so they were added as a consulting agency within the code as well. So we'll talk about that very briefly. Here's an example. I won't go into any great detail, but Claude Moore Park, up in Loudoun County. This one example is, you can see the one road at the bottom of the screen was approved by the board in 1993. And then what happened, that got access into the museum site. Subsequently later, it's in 1993, subsequently back later in 2001, working with DCR, they came back to us and said, we have a new location for a visitor center that doesn't have adequate access. So the board granted access to that site at that time. Again, the concern was under the strict interpretation of the code, we weren't sure we were able to do that, so we got that clarified back in 2005. I won't go through this in any detail. This is simply just giving you, for your reference, the exact changes in the code to clarify again, working with DHR, the ability to work with multiple sites within one recreational or historical site. So again, you have a copy of the policy that we'll be bringing to you. It's in its draft form. We've done it in track changes, so you can see what we tried to change. Really just simply reflects, clarifies some things. We've taken away some of the stipulations and concise requirements for bikeways, tried to make that a little broader to be more in line with CPB's policy on bicycle and pedestrian facilities, and clarified some of the existing language. Once, if it is the board's wish that we approve that next month, we'll go forward and update our internal guide so that the localities and our staff in the districts and residencies will have a better document to work off of. The last bullet in our effort to make sure on fiscal responsibility, we are proposing that in our guide that we start putting more emphasis on moving projects forward within a certain amount of time frame. You see that in our last bullet. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that's my six slides or less on recreational access.
Okay. Questions of Mr. Estes?
Quick question. Are these requests generated only by DCR, or can they be generated by the site, a locality, a private entity, a nonprofit that runs the site? I mean, how do these things come to us?
Great question. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Koolame, typically it's going to be at the local level. The locality is working with an entity or an authority or to generate that at the local government level. They'll contact DCR to generate the site interest and get the qualifications through DCR, maybe the Department of Historic Resources. And then we kind of come into it towards the latter stages of the planning stages of, well, how do we get access to it? And that's where VDOT comes in to help with that.
Okay, so we'll see this at next month's CTB business session, correct?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Estes. That concludes the work session. We'll recess until 3 o'clock, and we'll come back and take the business agenda up, hopefully briskly. And then again, remember, at 5 o'clock, we have the RAP 29 discussions. That is for interested members of the CTB. We know there will be more than four, so it is a public meeting, but that is not part of the official agenda. So if you don't have an interest in the 29 study, don't feel compelled to stay.
If anybody wants to.
Right now, Daniel.